tough crowd, having cut his teeth in music journalism, Graham Linehan became the finest sitcom writer of his generation. He captured the comedy zeitgeist, not just the co-creator of Father Ted, and If You Know, You Know, but with the It's Crowd and Black Books, winning 5 BAFTAs and a Lifetime Achievement Award. What happened next was unbelievable. It is covered in the book Tough Crowd. Delighted to say that Graham joins us live on the line now. Graham, good morning to you.
Hello there. Thank you for speaking to me.
Pleasure is indeed all mine. So, I mean, Father Ted, just first off, you know, come on, just absolutely wonderful. Congratulations. It must be to have something like that that invades the national consciousness, and even now people look at it and go, do you remember that? You can just drop lines off it and people will sort of start smiling. I mean, it must give you a warm feeling in various regions.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, it was just a very fortunate meeting of minds with me and Arthur. Arthur had a few priests who were uncles and so on, and he was very fond of them and used to tell these great stories. The more he spoke about them, the funnier the world seemed, really. You know, it seemed so polite and sweet and unworldly that it felt like a great world to put a set of comedy, you know.
And it was a different world, but at the same time it obviously tapped a nerve, because those of us who don't know Ireland or don't know that situation, because if you said, oh yeah, it's a bunch of priests on an island, and they said, well, that's not good, that's going to niche market if ever there was one. but something obviously touched a nerve worldwide, because it just became this, you know, and you can, the word is bandied around, so it doesn't make any sense anymore, but it became this classic, it became this staple. And what is it now? It's kind of something years ago. I always think it's about 5 years, and then it turns out to be 25, 30 years ago or something.
It's about 30 years now, yeah.
There you go.
Isn't that insane?
It is. Blinking, you'll miss it, and the saying goes. So You're picking up Lifetime Achievements Awards, which you must be thinking, I'm not finished yet, and BAFTAs, which again you must be pinching yourself. So all this going well, but Tough Crowd is it could be, you know, you and your showbiz pals and schmoozing and the whole thing, but it's what's happening next and how things can change. Just explain a little bit about the call it the hill you're going to die on, and explain A, what that means, and B, what it was.
Well, I should point out that most of the book isn't about this. This is kind of this weird world that I've entered into, which is almost like a sitcom in itself, only happened in the last, 30% of my life, and therefore in the book, you know. I just basically started defending women online who I saw were being, who were losing their livelihoods, who were being reported to the police, who were getting in trouble with their accreditation bodies, who were kind of being tied up in year-long inquiries into their behavior, or years-long sometimes. And I thought it was wrong. So I started talking about it. And the moment I started talking about it, I just became the subject of a series of harassment campaigns, and the campaign to destroy my reputation. So instead of folding, I just decided to keep going, because I didn't have a boss or anyone who would who I could get in trouble with. And it just kept coming. The kind of offers started falling away, work offers, and I haven't really worked properly in about 6 years. I haven't worked in comedy in about 6 years, you know.
When did you start doing this? Because obviously this is pre Me Too, isn't it? I mean, this is before everything.
It was just after. Right. It was just after. And I found it hilarious that everybody was so concerned about women in Me Too, and then they just completely dropped them as soon as this came along. It was around 2018, you know. So it was before J.K. Rowling became involved. And it was before Martina Navratilova became involved to the extent that she has. And I don't think any of us realized quite how vicious the activists on the other side were, you know. They had all these techniques, like they would not speak about it. You'll notice in these last 5 years, there's very few interviews with trans activists, because they knew that if they didn't talk about it, then the subject simply wouldn't be covered, because most channels have a kind of a balance rule where if one person is speaking up about a subject, a second person must present the opposite view. So they just wouldn't appear. So the whole conversation just wasn't happening. Mm. And we were trying to just say, look, there's a few problems. They only exist in a few different spaces, like women's, for instance, rape crisis centers. They have to be kept all female. Female sports have to be kept fair. And, you know, we weren't saying anything controversial. But because of the storm around every single thing we said, or in some cases didn't say, they were able to just kind of, you know, trample our reputations and undermine our ability to get work.
One of the thing is, and the thing about this balance rule, which didn't used to happen, especially on certain channels, but, you know, I always have this thing about, because I do a phone-in program every Tuesday for my sins, and we get people phoning in. It's live, and believe me, we're a broad church here. And I always say, because people said, oh, I found it online, and I always say, if you want to find out that the world is run by a secret cabal of underground hamsters who are 12 foot tall and orange called Nigel, you will find a website saying that the world is run by a secret cabal of underground hamsters called Nigel. And so, but in the interest of balance, by that rule, you could have somebody saying, look, the world is not run by our furry little friends, but you'd have to put in somebody who's passionately believed that the world was run by an underground cabal of 12-foot ginger hamsters called Nigel. So that's what you're up against, isn't it?
Yeah, a friend of mine, a Welsh feminist named Helen Staniland, she once said, trans rights activists do not talk about what will not argue their points on the grounds they might incriminate themselves. Because when they say if you were to say these arguments out loud, they amount to things like, yeah, I think a man should be able to fight a woman in the ring, you know, which happened yesterday. A female boxer pulled out of a fight and the man won by default. The male, trans-identified male won by default. And, you know, first of all, you have to ask yourself, what kind of a man would cheat at women's sports? But what kind of a man would cheat at women's sports to the extent that he will enter into a combat sport with them? You know, so that's not a popular position, I think, among the wider public. I don't think the wider public want to see that. But because of the way the debate has been stifled, it's been made to appear like we're saying something that's controversial. And we really aren't. We're just
debate. Now, you see, we're the same generation, and debate was debating society down, you know, you had two speakers on each side, and you had a debate, right? And it was face-to-face, you put your case forward, you listened, you came back. Since that their internet has come online, there is no debate. There is a you only have to look at what's been happening in the past couple of weeks, you know, with the marches and against the marches, and there are no sides of grey, shades of grey. You are either for us or against us. There is no debate. I will shout you down on the internet because there's no comeback, and I can be as outrageous as I want to be because I'm not physically sitting in a room with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And people behave in a way online that they don't do in other circumstances. The vile abuse I see sent women, it wouldn't survive for a moment on a program like this. You would shut it down because it would be so appalling to actually hear it. But one of the things I was trying to do was use my platform. I had about 900,000 followers at one point. And they were a lot of them were bullied and pressured into unfollowing me. So I lost about 300,000 followers, over the years I started talking about it. Oh God, I forgot. So what point was I going to make there?
About the fact that, you know, having debate being debate and online debate is not real debate because, you know, it's you know, you're sitting behind a screen and you're thousands of miles away from anybody.
Sorry, I know what it was. I thought that platform was big enough to try and show other people how this debate was being composed. So I would share some of the nastiest tweets sent to women online and say, you know, this is what women are going through. And that was considered, they really didn't like that because they like to, the people I'm talking about, and believe me, there's lots of good people on the other side of this debate to me who really believe that, you know, that they're being kind and understanding of a very, very small minority of people who just want to live their lives. I think the vast majority of people in this debate are people who think like that. However, there is a kind of what you might call the kind of active campaigners who use threats to livelihood, who use smears, faked screenshots, everything they can do to make someone seem like a bad person, you know? And I just like bringing attention to it, you know, because I thought it was so underhanded.
Yeah, but you see, the problem is that people get on this, and strident is a word I probably use on this one as well, you know, going after, and you get to a point where you just go, to be misconstrued like that, to say, look, I'm just putting a light on this, I'm just talking about this. But of course, again, as I said before, in this polarized world in which we live, if you step out of line or you have an opinion that is 5% to the left or to the right of whatever they're saying, then and yourself being quote unquote in the public eye, which you didn't ask for, then suddenly you find this campaign by oppositional people who don't agree with you and think, right, well, he's a legitimate target.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess so. When you take an unpopular stance, you got to expect that to some extent. And I've always taken stances that have got me into trouble in one way or another. But like, they're all based on things like, you know, I do think that for instance, I'll give you one example that people don't really know. You know, I once joined a lesbian dating app. I sent in a photograph. I changed my pronouns to she, her. And I got on. And the reason I did that was because men were doing this in their droves. So you have like lesbians who are trying to meet women and they've got all these men who aren't even trans, some of them. Some of them look like I look now. I'm wearing it. We're both dressed kind of the same. Checked short sleeve shirt, not really making much of an effort to look like a woman. You have a beard. And these men were on this lesbian dating app. Yeah, exactly. So it's like you have these women are being kind of quietly and with the permission of the app itself, you know, the subject of homophobic bullying. Because if a lesbian is on a dating app, she doesn't want to see other men. Or she doesn't want to see men. She wants to see other women, you know.
Mm.
So it's things like that. It's like a hidden homophobia, a hidden misogyny. All sorts of things are going on, but they were going on under the surface of the debate and no one was covering them. You know, no one was speaking about it.
And again, you say the commission, the editors, all your ideas were suddenly being taken up, and that's going to be entirely confusing and dispiriting because this is, you know, being a writer is a solitary life. Despite the BAFTAs it is the job for Mad Men. You sit there, it's a bit like radio. You sit there, you know, working away, and nobody can be listening, nobody can be reading. You have no idea, and so your interaction with the outside world is basically sending off to commissioning editors or getting commissions coming in, and so that you know they're out there. And if it suddenly starts to change and you don't have a right to reply, that's extremely dispiriting. That's, you know, throw the laptop against the wall time, surely, Graham.
Yeah, well, you know, I wrote an entire Father Ted musical with Arthur Matthews and Neil Hannon. Neil used to do the music, music from the show.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and My Lovely Horse and things like that. And we had it on its feet. It was ready to go. I worked on it for 3 years. I put like everything into it, trying to make sure that it was, justified as a kind of final part of Father Ted. And they offered me £200,000 to walk away from it, you know, and I refused because I don't think I'm doing anything wrong. This is an important debate. Women need private spaces. Children shouldn't be sterilized and mutilated in gender clinics. And I just, you know, don't think that, you know, if we start to say there are certain subjects, especially subjects that concern the health and well-being of children, that are out of bounds, then it's not a world I want to be a part of, you know? So I'm going to keep, it's an annoying thing to have to fight, but I'm still fighting to get my musical back. Patrick are sitting on it for no good reason. And the vast majority of people in this country agree with me.
And music by Neil Hannon, The Divine Comedy. I mean, come on. I mean,
yeah.
And also, you know, if you're looking for, you know, with last time I looked, The Divine Comedy weren't some sort of, you know, knuckle-drugging sort of thrash metal band, were they? Let's face it, they're as sympathetic as it gets.
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, Neil hasn't really said anything in my defense, neither has Arthur. Well, no, actually, Arthur did say one thing, but he said it was about free speech. But what I'm really looking for my former colleagues, is someone just to say, hang on a sec, arguing for fair sports, arguing for proper evidence behind transitioning, arguing that women shouldn't lose their livelihoods for wanting these things. You know, it's not controversial. It's something that if only a few more people, you know, were brave about this and added their voice to mine, I wouldn't be quite so isolated and they wouldn't be able to kind of destroy my career the way they have.
So when it comes to writing a book like this, A, difficult not to say, to make it a bleeding heart, poor me. And also, you don't want to get hijacked by that other crowd who go, yeah, he's right. You know what I mean? It's like man is a man, you know, the women for a woman. Because that's the other problem, isn't it, Graham? You can get as we've seen over recent events, suddenly you've got a bunch of people who you really don't want with you saying, oh, yeah, I support him because, you know, that's how it should be.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what happens when you cast, like, the vast majority of people in this fight are left-wing feminists, you know? Like, the people, the real people who made the kind of fight back against this stuff were left-wing feminists. Like, one person I count as a friend is Helen Steele, who you may remember is the woman who single-handedly was sued by McDonald's and ran her own defense and won, you know? These are, like, proper heroes of left-wing feminism, and they've all been portrayed as if they're in the EDL, you know, and it's just absurd. And of course, when you portray someone like that, then those types of people will gravitate over. It really is just a part of the smear campaign that these activists engage in, that's just designed to make people saying normal things sound like they've gone out of their mind.
Book is called Tough Crowd, but it must have been a tough one to write to make it, you know, like I said, to I was going to say to bring balance, but we had that before. But you know what I'm saying? To make it, this is how the career went, and the great stuff, like you said, it's not a straight off the bat, you know, this has happened to me, this is awful. It's obviously it's the roller coaster ride and the fabulous ride that was Father Ted, etc.
Yeah, it's like I think it's the only book that really talks about the making of it and how a show like Ted came into existence, you know, like thinking back on it, there were so many aspects that were that arrived because of like our producer, Jeffrey Perkins, who was also the producer of things like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh.
Yeah. And he was just a lovely man. He died very tragically. But he was the one who, you know, he chose the music. I remember we had two choices for the music. One was the song that's there now, and the other was his silly plinky plonky number. And we said we wanted a silly plinky plonky one because we said we were making fun of sitcoms. We were saying this should be, you know, we want to make fun of sitcoms. We want the plinky plonk one. And Jeffrey looked really hurt, and he said, "People will love these characters. Why do you want to make fun of your own characters?" And we just kind of sat there quietly and thought, oh, yeah, okay, maybe not. And that's why the music that's there now is the music that's there now.
Yeah.
And every time people hear it, it cheers them up because even though it's quite a melancholy song, it reminds them of the show. It's a lovely thing.
And also it's...
Largely accidental.
And the thing is, I mean, it's a warm blanket to put around you in these troubled times, but B, it's a language. I mean, it is now, if you know Father Ted and you say things like, come on, come on, come on, or whatever, feck, if you know, you know, and suddenly you have this bond with complete strangers, which is a wonderful thing, Graham.
Yeah. Well, there's a bit in it about when we went to the Father Ted weekend, where everybody was dressed as priests and nuns and cardinals and tea ladies and so on. And except for us, me and Arthur were just dressed as we would normally be dressed. And people were looking over and going, who are those two? You know, and we could see them being told we were the writers. And they suddenly got super self-conscious. They would just like shrink in their cassocks. And it was like, and I realized it was because we were interrupting the fantasy they'd built up in their minds that this was a real thing and they're now a part of it. So we never went back because we just thought we're spoiling it for these people by reminding them it's real, you know?
What do you hope that people take from Tough Crowd?
Well, you know, from my personal point of view, there's so much misinformation and so much rumor around what, you know, I actually did, that it was important for me to set it out exactly what happened to me. So, yeah, I'm just hoping that people... But, you know, beyond that, I didn't want it to be a book just about the kind of... about that aspect. So it's actually kind of a guide to writing sitcoms as well, you know, and it's a kind of, in artistic terms, it's trying to show people that a good show is made when you're open to ideas, when you're generous with arguments and, you know, you can kind of, craft something interesting if you subject it to a kind of friendly scrutiny from a group of people who all want it to be good. And that's what I, you know, that's what I loved about being on the crew. It's what I loved about making TV shows. And I guess I also wanted to show what a tragedy it is when that's taken away from someone who's kind of lived for it, you know?
And, you know, in a world where we have the theatre of the cruel, if you like, there's something, isn't there? So there's something, you laugh at Father Ted, but like all great sitcoms, that there's a humanity in it. There's a fondness in it. There's not a cruelty. You're not laughing at a character. You're laughing, hopefully, with a set of characters.
Yeah, well, you know, we could have been a lot harsher on the church in the show. But we used to, you know, we used to just do ridiculous things. Like, you know, we would have, I don't know, I think in the background of one shot, you can see in the Vatican, the popes are bowling with champagne bottles as the pins, you know. But like it's, I think it was suggested one, but it's like, you know, it was very exaggerated. It was very silly. It wasn't like, we were never interested in satirical humor with a capital S. We wanted our satire to make fun of everybody, you know? So, you know, in one episode we had a kind of Sinead O'Connor figure. And, you know, I actually briefly was friends with Sinead's family, and I was worried she wouldn't like it. But then at the Christmas episode, we found her sitting in the front row, you know? So it was like, you know, we were... And priests would come up. One priest came up to me once and he said, "You don't know the half of it."
Aye.
If people, and I thought, I thought, what? Yeah. What? Well, it's worse. It's worse than this. So, you know, people just, we didn't set out to be cruel or even too pointed about the church. We just wanted to make a silly show about men who never grew up, who were in the kind of job that allowed that, you know? And it worked well for us.
If people want to find you online and not give you some abuse, where's the best place to find you?
Well, I'm still shadow banned on Twitter, but you can, my Twitter name is Glinner, so Glinner. You can find me through that. I also have a Substack where we report on the various issues we've been talking about today, called the Glinner Update. And the book is available in, you know,
As a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Tough Crowd. It's by Graham Linnean. Graham, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.